Maybe we'll go ahead and start. My name is Charlie Mazin, and this afternoon we're going to be talking about what does the Old Testament say about God, using Klaus Westermann's book by that same title. And before we get into the book, I'd be interested to know, in your parishes, how many of you have heard, or if you're a pastor, preached 5 Old Testament sermons in the last year? Have we heard in our parishes or whatever as many as 5, as many as 2?
Maybe two.
It was October of last year at a seminar that Norman Hobble had on preaching and the Bible, and he really stressed the fact, or asked us, we were all pastors, how many of us had preached on the Old Testament in the last year and how many times, and that convinced me that at least in my preaching, the Old Testament was a very much neglected part of the Scripture. And so I decided that I would start preaching in Advent of last year on Old Testament text. And so I have spent all of the last year on Old Testament texts, almost without exception. I think that my preaching last year was better than it has been in a long time. And certainly for me it was more fun. And I think for the people, more fun. Because the thing that the Old Testament, I think, helps us recapture is the totality of life as it's viewed scripturally. The Old Testament is much more earthy and mundane and tends to keep life together in places where, if we don't have that Old Testament understanding, we tend to separate what we call the spiritual from the physical. The Christian life has to do with the great spiritual things. And the Old Testament doesn't allow a divorce like that. It weds all of our life together. And so I've had a delightful time with the Old Testament. When I was in seminary, by some accident or other, and it was not planned, I ended up with more hours in Old Testament than in any other of the disciplines in the seminary. And so I've always had some kind of interest in the Old Testament. The thesis that Westermann wishes to develop, I think, is one that we need to get around and get our head into a little bit. And so if you have a book, even the back page of the fly cover, the dust cover on it, will give you some indication about what he's going to do, because he outlines the book in terms of the chapters that he's going to talk about. As you maybe noticed from the introduction to this, these were given as a series of lectures at Union Seminary in Richmond, Virginia. Union Seminary is the seminary, it's a seminary of the Presbyterian Church that probably publishes the best journal on Bible and theology in this country. The journal is entitled Interpretation. So they do a lot of stuff with biblical materials. Anyway, looking at that background or outline, using what he says on the back of the dust cover, two things I want to pull out of that. Notice that chapter 2 and 3 are really getting at the heart of what he wants to say, that you have the saving God and the blessing God, that those are categories, those are biblical categories, and that he would argue in this book that it's absolutely essential, if you're going to understand the message of the whole Bible, and especially the Old Testament, that you understand the concept of the God who saves and the concept of the God who blesses. You can come in and sit down kind of any place, I guess. So. And then out of this framework of the God who blesses and the God who saves, he develops what he considers to be the Old Testament statements about God. The reason that I find this book to be so significant for me is that it wants to recover for us the fact that, that there is great texture and diversity in the Old Testament. That it is that, that one of the images that I use and here at Holden, all of my Bible studies up to this point have been on the Old Testament, and I use this picture to begin with. What you have in the Old Testament are biblical conversations, and that that there are many understandings about God, and there are many discussions about responding to Him that go on in the Old Testament. And that, that what we are called to do, I think, first of all, is to listen to these various voices that are speaking in the Old Testament. And I'll use an example of that that I think is fairly blatant and clear. You all are familiar, I'm sure, with Ezra and Nehemiah. And the thrust of Ezra and Nehemiah's message is that as we are reconstituted in the Promised Land in Palestine, in Israel, following the exile in Babylonia, that if we're going to rebuild the society, we must rebuild a pure society. And it must be a racially pure society. And so the thrust of Ezra and Nehemiah is that those of you men who have married foreign wives, you must get rid of them. And so Ezra builds very carefully the case for getting rid of them and goes through the whole process, and then they even list the husbands who have had foreign wives, and the book ends by saying that all of these wives and their children were sent away, period. I think it's the saddest statement in the Bible. Close to it. Then you have the book of Ruth. Now it's interesting, in Ezra and Nehemiah, the lists of foreign women who are to be avoided, the lists vary from one another, but one thing is always constant in them is that Moabites are always mentioned as women that you must not have anything to do with. When you get to the book of Ruth, Ruth is called a Moabitess 13 times. Ruth is not just a little love story. And when you come to the end and the close of the book of Ruth, Ruth is listed as the wife of Boaz, who is the has a child by the name of Obed, who has a child by the name of Jesse, who has a child by the name of David. The book of Ruth argues vehemently with Ezra and Nehemiah, saying, if we would have followed what was proposed in Ezra and Nehemiah, we wouldn't have had David as our king. And interesting that Ruth makes also the lists of the women, and there are only four outside of Mary, listed in the genealogy of Jesus. And all four of those women are foreign women, not Jewish. They all have some questionableness about them, and that is for another Bible study. But the point I'm making in this is that in the Old Testament you have conversations. You have conversations about whether Israel ought to have a king or not and what the theological significance of that is. You have differences in terms of how well they followed God's commands in settling the country. In chapter 11 of Joshua, when the book ends, it says that the Lord says to Joshua, you are old and you have conquered everything I told you to conquer. Chapter 13 begins, the Lord saying to Joshua, you are old and there is yet much territory to be conquered. You've got to ask yourself, what's going on here? And that's the question that I believe the Old Testament wants to set up for us. Because I don't think the people that the community of faith that put the Old Testament together was stupid enough to know that you've got two different points of view here. The first chapter of Genesis has a different order of creation, a different concern in the creation than the second chapter does. Very clear. You have an orderly thing, and you have animals created in the morning of the sixth day and human beings. And then in the second chapter, you have a male person created first, then the other animals to be a helpmate, and then finally woman. That's very different. Any third grader with any skills at all will know that we have difference, you know, there's a conversation going on. Now, I think that's very important for us to understand about the dynamic of the Scripture and especially the Old Testament. Just this is a digression now, but in the New Testament, and one of the fun things about reading the New Testament in this same way, if you look at the way the gospel writers deal with the disciples, did it ever occur to you that the disciples are handled differently in all four of the gospels? In Mark's gospel, the first one written, the thing that Jesus most often says to the disciples is this: don't you understand? In Mark's gospel, the disciples are gross stupid. They never understand. And you can just trace that through. In fact, when you get to after the feeding, the second feeding miracle, and they're on the boat and they're going across the sea, and they have one loaf of bread, and Jesus says, what about the bread of the scribes and the Pharisees? And they say to one another, well, he knows we only have one loaf of bread. And then Jesus says, now, when we fed the 5,000, how many loaves, or how many baskets did we have left over? Well, we had 12. Well, good. When we fed the 4,000, how many did we have left over? Well, we had 7. Good. Good answer. And then Jesus says, but don't you understand? Don't you understand? That's the key to the disciples in Mark. In Matthew, Jesus does not say to them, don't you understand? He says to them, O you of little faith. That's the theme. And if you look at the parallel passages, he always comes down on, O you of little faith. I think I'm a Matthean disciple. I know a lot, but I never have faith enough to get it in gear. And then when you move to Luke, Mary becomes the ideal disciple who keeps the words of Jesus, ponders them in her heart, and acts on them. That's the ideal disciple in Luke. And then in John, you have a whole other kind of concern about the disciples, and they all play a specific role. Like, for instance, when Jesus says in the Synoptic Gospels, one of you will betray me. And then the writer tells us, they all began together to say, Lord, is it I? Not in John. Judas from the very beginning is marked. Okay, now I want to lay that open to tell you that I think there's a dynamic in Scripture. And let's pick up now, if you've got access or can share these books, I'll kind of walk through a few things. I promised you when I was hawking this book that you would never read the Old Testament the same way again. And I really believe that to be true, that this book will challenge the way that we understand the Old Testament. And the point that I think that is most important for us to see is that what Vesterman argues for in the first chapter of this book is that the Old Testament is verbal. In other words, it's the basic grammar of the Old Testament is the verb, not the noun. That the action is more important than the concept. And that we must get in our head. When Moses is confronted by the burning bush and Yahweh reveals himself to Moses in the burning bush in Exodus 3:13 and following, and Moses says, what is your name? God says, I am who I am. Or it may be better translated, as the scholars now tell us, I will be who I will be. I said in a Bible study up here earlier this summer that in essence God was saying the big verb. I'm the big verb. The big verb. And that God is understood in the Hebrew mind in verbal terms, not noun terms. Interesting. That to me it's interesting that you know, part of our trouble, I think, of understanding even the New Testament is that for us faith is not a verb. Faith is a noun. And we would be far better off to translate pistuo, the word for faith or belief in the New Testament, as trust. Because trust is both verb and noun. And tends more to be verbal than it tends to be a noun. So, the concept that Vesterman argues for is that the Old Testament is, first of all, a story. And that it is a story between God and His people. And His people includes, as you will see as you read through the book, in which he gets into, is particularly in the third chapter on blessing, that that it is a story between God and all, and his people includes the whole of humanity, everyone. So he takes off and let's see if I can find the best place to say this. Page 14, the top of page 14. The theology of the Old Testament thus remains determined in every aspect by the outline of a story which has been entrusted to us and to which belong the occurrence of God speaking and the response of those who experience these events. The Old Testament is a story. In fact, as he's going to argue later on, we might say it is many stories. One of the things that he argues for throughout the book, and this is something I think we need to lift up so that you can hear it as you read this book, is that the story changes according to the historical situation of his people. That before Israel is a people, and when they are down in Egypt and they cry out, there is no talk about sin, that they are not being oppressed because of sin. And God hears their prayer, and then they move out of that situation. Now, after they are a people, after God has demonstrated his love for them over and over and over again, and they, you know, they get into trouble over and over again, then the God's dealing with the people begin when he comes to them in their need. The first movement is a movement of forgiveness in order to restore them. I mean, after he's punished them and all of that for their sin, then we begin to talk about forgiveness, but not in that first instance. It's interesting that Vesterman points out for us that when we deal with the story of the patriarchs, Abraham and Jacob, even though Jacob is a real scoundrel in one of the accounts about him, he doesn't need forgiveness. It isn't brought up. Very interesting. And then when the Joseph story comes and there is the dealing with sin, it's a broken community between brothers that needs restoring through forgiveness. And so there's, you know, he really challenges us in many ways to read the material as the material presents itself, and not to read it with our New Testament and even more removed our Lutheran eyes, because we impress on the scriptures certain kinds of things. And I want to be sure before this day is over to show you how he challenges some very basic Lutheran positions about reading the Old Testament. I'd love him for that, because I don't know what to do with it. I mean, my whole theological training is called into question by the challenges that he lays to us. And I think I have struggled through this now for a couple years after reading this book, and I believe he's absolutely right. Page 24, another very important comment. He says, here we find a fundamental difference between Israel and its neighbors. If there are many gods, what is happening happens in the first place between the gods, between divine beings. In the first place, and I want to say, digress a minute, there is no question that there is going on in the Old Testament a contest between God and the other gods. That's not, and he's not eliminating that by this discussion. He doesn't get into that in this book. But when God reveals himself to Israel in the Exodus experience, there's also something else going on. And that is that he's going to show Pharaoh who's God. I mean, that's very clear. It's over and over again you hear this, I'm going to teach Pharaoh who's God. And also in the creation story, the first creation story, the sun and the moon and the stars are not created until the fourth day, and they are never called by name. In the first creation account, you ever think about that? They are called the greater light and the lesser light. And it said, what is their purpose? Well, they'll give light in the day and light at night, and we'll count the seasons and the days by them. But they're there to serve the creation. And certainly you would never worship something that was made to serve the creation, would you? Well, they're doing it down in Egypt. And so they're laughing at those people who worship a God that wasn't even around till the fourth day, or something as God that wasn't around till the fourth day. So anyway, the primary emphasis is not this what's happening in the first place between the gods, between divine beings. If there is only one God, all that is happening takes place between this one God and his creation, including people. The confession to the one God is a response to the work of the one God, work dedicated only to his creation and only to his people. Because he alone is God, he makes possible a history between God and the world, beginning with God and ending with God. I am the first and I am the last. I think that's important that Old Testament theology says that God creates history. And it's a history in relation. History can be understood only in relationship to God. There is no history without God. And of course, the point that, and the argument that he has with 19th century liberalism and even 20th century, I suppose, biblical criticism in many places is that they want to understand everything in terms of a history of phenomenon, of stuff that happens here. And he says, if you've eliminated this dialogue between God and people, then you cannot ever understand the scriptural witness of the God of the Old Testament and the New Testament either. Okay, I'll stop with that so we have a chance. Any questions or comments about what I've said to this point, or if you've read this, any questions or comments you have about the first chapter?
When you speak of history, what do you mean?
When he speaks of history, he says the biblical understanding of history. Now, that's really important that we put
what
that.
What do you mean by history?
Yeah, what he says it means is it's this dialogue in terms of word and event between God and his people, and his people understand in their events that he is that what they are engaged in is not only meeting historical phenomenon, but they are meeting God in these events.
Which events?
All events. We'll get into that. All events. This is where he wants to blow out of our normal understandings of where God meets us. And he thinks the Christians and the way we've handled the Old Testament is that we've been so saving oriented that we haven't seen the blessing activity of God.
In recent years, I feel there has been more appreciation for and attention being given to the Old Testament. That even shows up in the OBW with
right.
much more emphasis on the Psalms. And I've appreciated hearing more frequently a phrase, salvation history, and then he says that's an incorrect phrase as applies to the Old Testament. And I hope you'll explain his concern about that.
Some of what we have to understand is the German background out of which Westermann speaks, and the whole Heilsgeschichte school of understanding the Old Testament. And his argument is that I think his argument basically, when you boil it all down, is that if you get involved only in salvation history and God's dealing only with this peculiar and particular people, you have missed what he calls, in essence, the bookends, that God is the beginning and the end, that he's involved in this blessing activity. And then you have the problem, and this is a problem that Christians, I believe, have, worse maybe than most people, is of a terrible exclusivism and arrogance that grows out of that, to think that God could possibly ever work with, could possibly ever bless or even save people outside of who we think he ought to be saving and blessing. I'm going to deal with that in the Bible study on Saturday morning with Jonah. Jonah is really an interesting book about God's saving and blessing activities. I mean, it's an incredible book. But the point is that I think he argues that salvation history imposes a structure on the Old Testament that is too limiting. Because what do you do with all these other folks who... you know, as he quotes the passage from Matthew, when Jesus says that God is the God who causes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust alike. I mean, that's the problem with salvation history. The unjust are just there to do in or to be a foil for the just. And he thinks they have other, God has other things in mind for them, I think.
Do you have any key to Jesus' interpretation of it? I mean, do we from the Gospels find out how Jesus looked upon history of the Old Testament?
Well, he has a section on Jesus and on the Old Testament and Jesus.
Okay.
And part of, you know, he does not specifically in this book cover that with a great deal of, because he has a book entitled The Old Testament and Jesus Christ.
Uh-huh.
So that's not a major concern in this book. And so one would have to go to that source to get, you know, to be specific about how he understands Jesus to be using the Old Testament. His concern here is that we will understand Jesus much more fully if we understand the Old Testament. And if we understand the God of the Old Testament. In fact, it's interesting how, is it chapter 3 he ends with? No, it must be chapter 4 then. It's chapter 4. When he comes down to talking about the compassion of God, and this is page 64, he said, "But the servant is only spoken of in a veiled manner and by hints. He does not have a name. Only outside the Old Testament is he given a name. Even then it will be God's compassion turning to human suffering which sends the mediator, for God so loved the world." I mean, he is very strong about I think, in terms of seeing. And he believes, you know, and I think he's absolutely right, that, you know, the language, the salvation language of the New Testament has its roots in the Old Testament. All of the vocabulary that's used to describe what God has done in Jesus Christ in the New Testament has its origins in the Old. And we try to understand that without understanding the Old Testament. To look at God as Savior, the saving God and history, if you'll turn to page 28. He wants to argue that the saving activity of God is seen in several different levels and ways in the Old Testament. That God is, as he says on the bottom of page 27 in the heading there, God is the Savior of individuals, humanity, and all creatures. It's interesting, the psalm this morning, you know, that Scott Olson used for Matins was Psalm 148. And if, as you read this book, you'll see that he refers to that psalm three or four times in this book. And part of it has to do with the all-encompassing nature of the praise that is spoken of in that psalm. He sees that as critical. In fact, this is to jump ahead of ourselves a little bit. He says, you know, faith is not used very often. The word is not used very often in the Old Testament. That kind of is an interesting little thing. We talk about Abraham believed God, had faith in him, was reckoned to him as righteousness. But then you get pretty skinny after that. And so praise. It's praise. Interesting. Anyway, looking at page 28, then, and this is the thing that I think is helpful to us in terms of preaching, and in terms of our understanding of God's activity. This is the second to the last paragraph on that page. He's talking about saving. He says, it is based on the fact that human beings are creatures. They are created for life. And the Hebrew word that's transliterated there means living beings. But their life is limited. It follows from the limitations of human life as betrayed in Genesis 2:3, that as long as humans live, they are in danger, assailable, and vulnerable. If they survive the danger, they know the experience of being saved. This applies to the individual, any human community, and to humanity as a whole. There is no human existence without danger. Being saved is part of human existence. Now that's not what we mean by being saved, usually in the New Testament sense. And what he's arguing for is that we have so constricted what it means to be saved that we don't know what it means to be saved in the biblical sense.
Can you come again with that meaning of being saved there?
Okay, he says there is no human existence without danger, and he's delineated what those dangers are. I mean, we live a very fragile, dangerous existence. We could get wiped out at any moment, and there are threats to us, and we get saved from those threats often. And so he says, there's no human existence without danger. Being saved is part of human existence. That if we were to think in those Old Testament categories, every human being alive has had their life spared. Every nation, every tribe, every family has had their life spared. Now that, you know, that for him is where you begin the discussion of what it means to be saved. Now that's not to deny, in fact that's to try to enlarge, that there is a particular and peculiar sense of being saved in relationship to the God of Israel, to the God of Jesus Christ. But that you start with the sense, with the experience, and he tries to show this in terms of the Old Testament's witness to all being saved. Then, when he starts to talk about the saving acts in history, or the act of saving in history on page 29, he tries to show us how Israel developed a picture frame, a filter by which they saw life. And I think this is important for us. Jürgen Moltmann, in a book of sermons called Liberation Preaching or something like that, the title escapes me right now, but Jürgen Moltmann has a series of sermons, and in one of those sermons he says something that really, to me, it really makes a lot of sense. He said, most people think that experience makes faith, that we have an experience and that creates faith. He said, I think it's the other way around, that faith creates experience. In other words, what the perceptions that we take into a situation unpack it for us. Every one of us are bombarded every day with all kinds of stuff, more data than we can ever process with our computer that we call our life. What is it that helps us make sense of that? It's our faith. And I'm using that in large sense here. I don't want to use it only in the sense of Christian faith at this point in time. I'm just saying that our lived experience as it molds us and we mold it gives us a faith perspective. It can include God, it doesn't have to include God, but it's a filter, it's a frame. And through this frame, we take on experience and make sense of it. If we are a person who sees life negatively and everybody is against us and the neighbor doesn't say good morning to us today, that just proves it's just no good. If we're a person that tends to be more open and sensitive to people and the neighbor doesn't say good morning to us, we think, well, maybe they're having a bad day. Same experience, but seen with a different frame. Israel brought to its experience a frame of faith. And he says that frame of faith can be seen most nakedly in Deuteronomy 26, 5 through 11. And so on page 29, he gives a brief little outline of this frame of faith. It says, the process of saving in the Old Testament, this is the last full paragraph on that page, the process of saving in the Old Testament occurs in a certain characteristic sequence of events. Now, I would argue that the sequence of events may or may not be this sequence, but the understanding structures them this way to make sense of them. This is the biblical faith way of seeing things. You know, because a lot of times when things happen to us in our life, we perceive them in a fragmentary way, and then later on we can begin to understand the sequence of them. We make sense of them. Okay, so the process of saving in the Old Testament occurs in a certain characteristic sequence of events. Saving can take place in many different ways and can be presented in very different forms. But the basic structure always remains the same. Need, call out of need, hearing, saving, response of the saved persons. Two of these five elements are common to all talk of saving, especially to secular talk. The need and the turning away of the need, or saving. Like, you know, I got a headache. I just really have a headache. So I need help, and I get relief. That's secular talk. It has nothing to do with faith, but it is a way of, you know, he says, that's when I'm hungry. I got to get something to eat. That's mundane stuff. Okay. So that's common to all of these. The other three elements add the word to mere events. On the human side, the call out of need and the response of the saved persons. On God's side, the word of the Savior, which, when he hears of the call out of need, proceeds the saving intervention. These three elements turn the saving into an event in dialogue. By them, the experience of saving from need becomes an encounter with the saving God with which the history of Israel began. Then on the top of page 30, he gives you a way to see this frame. And this frame will fit over their interpretation of all kinds of events in the Bible. First of all, the previous history, which is a prologue. An Armenian ready to perish was my father. The RSV translates that, a wandering Armenian was my father. And it says he went down into Egypt, and then it says, like he says, the need is the Egyptians oppressed us. And when you look at the very beginning of the book of Exodus, the first thing it recounts for you is the fact that Jacob went down into Egypt, and how many people was he?
70.
And then what happens, and this is done in about five verses, he becomes a great and populous nation down there. Then immediately we start with the trouble. The Egyptians start to oppress them. And this is in this little form. And then there's the call from need. If you were to look in Deuteronomy 26, you would notice a change of preposition or of pronouns from he to we. They weren't down in Egypt, not even the people that were speaking this, but they shared the events. It's just like last Sunday we celebrated the 4th of July, and we talk about our Declaration of Independence. Well, I didn't sign it, but I claim it. Same thing is true here. Then we cried to Yahweh, he hears. And Yahweh heard us and saw our affliction. He saved us. Yahweh brought us out of Egypt. And he brought us into this place and gave us this land. And then the response, and now I bring the first fruit, and you shall bow down and rejoice. Interesting little detail if you read the Exodus story. When Moses and Aaron first go to Pharaoh and ask him if they can leave, what is the reason that they say they want to go? Why do they want to take the people out of Egypt for a picnic or whatever?
To worship.
Then if you read Exodus 15, which is the Song of Moses, it's an interesting thing that they celebrate the fact that God has brought them to Mount Zion to worship. It's the whole purpose of the whole thing. It's to worship. It's kind of, there's an irony in the story that, yes, not even they know what it means that they're going out to worship finally. But you read Exodus 15 sometime, the Song of Moses, and see. It hit me. I did a Bible study on this for my congregation this year. We were going to do the whole Bible. I was kind of going to sample little bits of it, and we made it to Exodus 20. So anyway, it's one way of ensuring you've got a job for a long time is to go through the whole Bible. Let me move on as quickly as I can to the blessing God, and I hope I just sample enough of this so that you get some sense of what he is talking about. Vesterman, in another one of his books called A Handbook to the Old Testament, which I really commend to you as an excellent introduction to the books of the Old Testament. He also has a New Testament introduction called Handbook to the New Testament. And he shows how the Exodus story is the core story in the Bible. And so you have to ask yourself the question, well, who were the folks that God rescued? Then you have the patriarchal history, Genesis 12 to 50. Then outside of that, you have to ask, well, how did they get here? Then you have the story of Genesis 1 to 11. Now, the point he makes in this section on blessing, it should occur to us that the story of the Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers are bracketed by Genesis and Deuteronomy. And if you read Genesis, what you have is a concern for the whole creation, especially the first 11 chapters, in which God wishes to bless the whole creation. And then in Deuteronomy speaks of blessing again, not saving. Deuteronomy is not about God saving his people. Deuteronomy is about God blessing his people and how they can ensure the blessing for themselves. Now he says it's important, and he uses this, and I'll use my own words for this, but it's important when we think about the saving activity of God, we ask ourselves a question, and let me use another story here. I remember a sermon preached by one of my seminary professors when I was in seminary, and he talked about he was driving down a road in Minnesota someplace, and high on a rock bank, on a railroad bridge over the highway, someone had climbed up there and written in big white letters, "Jesus saves." And then he said somebody else evidently had gotten up there and in yellow paint or some other color paint wrote, "Green stamps." And he said that really offended him, you know, "Jesus saves, green stamps." And then he got to thinking, and this was the point of his sermon, you are never saved just for the heck of it. You are always saved for a purpose. And God saves his people for a purpose. And Vesterman's point is, it's for the purpose of the blessing of the whole creation. You know, Harley Swiggum's theory, or little thesis, little cliche for the Bethel series is blessed to be a blessing. And that's Vesterman's point. If we don't understand that what God is about is blessing his whole creation, we miss it. Interesting, and we'll deal with this when we do Jonah on Saturday morning, that the book of Jonah ends with a question. It's the only Old Testament book, the only book of the Bible that I know of that ends with a question. And the question is, should I not be merciful to Nineveh and all these folks who don't know their right hand from their left hand, 120,000 of them, and much cattle? And Vesterman, you'll see throughout this book, makes a point about God's concern for the animals, his whole creation. He wishes us to be a blessing, even as he wishes to bless the whole creation. Then he makes a point also, and this is on page 40, and I'll quickly point up a few things, and then I'm going to give you some teasers for tomorrow to think about, because they're the ones where we Lutherans are most in trouble. The second paragraph, he says, "The blessing of the Creator is effective in the moment of the generations of the human race through time and through space. It is effective in the ever-constant rhythm of conception, birth, and death. With this rhythm of life, the workings of the Creator and the creation, reach into every generation, independent of all differences between people, of race, nation, or religion, as long as and wherever there is life, the Creator is at work. At the creation, the Creator acknowledges that it was good, because the word Tov, And that the B sounds like a V in Hebrew, because it doesn't have a doggish forte in it, a little dot in the B. Because the word tov means good and beautiful. Beauty belongs to the creation and is reflected back in praise of the Creator. One of the themes that you will see throughout this book as you read it is his playing with the idea of beauty. Beauty is a big concern of his, that we pick up again the Old Testament's appreciation for beauty. Okay, so what he's arguing in this kind of thing is that in essence there is no human life that has not known blessing. And that again, you know, that corresponds with his idea of saving. Now, to page 52. And I hate to just read conclusions for you, because I was going through this today and I thought, well, I could share this and I could share that, and then I figured out I could share something from every page, I think. Like you said, this book is packed, and that makes it difficult to unpack. In conclusion, the last two paragraphs of this chapter 3. In conclusion, we may say that God's working in blessing has obvious connections with similar elements in other religions, in the gift of the threefold blessing of fertility, in the structure of worship after the settlement, and in God's working in the family and in kingship. In all these areas, parallels in other religions can be found. The same applies to the working of God as the Creator and to the primeval history as a whole. God's saving cannot be separated from His blessing. Both are constantly interlocked and combined with each other, so both receive their due. The singularity and uniqueness of the history of God with His people in the one aspect of God's working, the agreement with other religions in the other. In other words, he's arguing the uniqueness of the Judeo-Christian understanding of God comes in the saving aspect, how God saves. In the blessing aspect, we share much with other religions. And we deny that, I believe, to our peril. And I could go in, there's a lot, we could really argue about that a lot, but I think that we need to see where the uniqueness comes. You know, Julius Wellhausen, really the father of Old Testament form criticism, pointed out all of the similarities between the Old Testament and the religions of the neighboring people of Israel. And so he developed, following Hegel, kind of an understanding of the progression of religion. And modern scholarship has said, well, there's sure a lot of truth to that, no question about it. Borrowed a lot of concepts from the neighboring religions. The interesting thing is what they chose not to borrow. That's why didn't they choose some of that stuff? That's another question. Let me close and leave a minute or two at least for questions, because tomorrow what I'd like to do is having given this introduction, and maybe you can wrestle with his material some, he wants to argue for a totally different way to look at the law. And so there are several different places where he talks about laws and commandments, but if you'll turn to page 75, I'll give you the biggest one, and the one that I think is the thing that, when I read this book, after that I have read the Old Testament in this aspect with much, I'm not sure where I'm coming with this, but anyway, he stopped me. He said, the middle of page 75, the difference between law and commandments. When we consider this large complex of commandments and laws, we are confronted with a difficult question for the theology of the Old Testament. Throughout the entire Jewish and Christian tradition, this large complex is understood, interpreted, and judged theologically by one concept, that of the law. The question is, can we continue to maintain that in the Old Testament, commandment and law have the same theological meaning and can thus be brought together under the concept of law? The text of the Old Testament reveal a completely clear and unequivocal distinction between commandments and laws. The commandment or prohibition is a single statement in which God speaks directly to people, "Thou shalt not." The law consists of two statements, an assumed situation and a determination of the consequences. Whoever does this and such a thing will happen to that person. The commandment is a direct proceeding between God and people. and in this regard corresponds to a commandment to depart or direction to follow in the pre-settlement period. In contrast, the law is not a direct word of God. In every case, it is tied to human institutions, since punishment requires some agency to execute the punishment. Laws about slavery presuppose a specific social order. And he goes on to talk about how when slavery then is no longer present, then you don't have a problem with, I mean, the law changes. And that the commandments never change. That that the commandments remain valid for all time. There's no intermediary. And he's talked about this once before in this book. That the commandment of God is unconditioned, unmediated. You shall have no other gods before me. Did it ever strike you as interesting that God doesn't say what he's going to do if you do that? You shall not kill. Does it God say what's going to happen to you if you do? Not in the commandments. Interesting. Now turn to page 93 and then we'll be done. This element of the Old Testament, the law, has been seen as decisive for the relationship of the Old Testament to Christ, particularly by Paul and after him in Christian theology. Indeed, it functioned as a contrast. It was rooted in Jewish theology in the centuries before Christ, this theology being the spiritual homeland of Paul, although it was not actually present in the Old Testament itself. There's your tip-off that he's going someplace else. Paul's contrast between the two ways of salvation, through works of the law and through the saving work of Christ, has no foundation in the Old Testament. That takes care of the small catechism in one, you know, in one kind of sense. I mean, Luther had an understanding of two ways of salvation. One based on law, the law made us shut our mouths. That's what Paul said. But what he's saying is that's not in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, there is not a single context in which the law is depicted as a means of salvation. Usually Deuteronomy is cited in this connection. The obedience of the people to the commandments, rules, and laws is made the condition of Israel's welfare in the Promised Land. But in Deuteronomy, observation of the law is not tied to salvation, but rather to the people's well-being, namely the blessing in the Promised Land. I'll let you finish that off, but I think that for me meant rereading the Old Testament. All right? I mean, that's just, he may be wrong. I mean, I'm not, but I haven't found it yet. I haven't found an exception to his broad statement that there's not one place in the Old Testament where our salvation depends on keeping the law.
Well, where does it in the New Testament?
Paul says that.
Where?
That if you look in Galatians.
Paul says that if the law could say, there would be no sacrifice.
Okay, so he's obviously putting it forth as a means of salvation.
No, as an impossible means.
But a means, it
No, the, I mean, it's a conception.
But
he's pointing out that people have this conception, but it's not right.
Well,
you can't be saved that way.
Okay, that I would argue with that. That's what he's, you know, what he's saying. But I think because he seems to indicate if we could do it, the law is a means of salvation, and the gospel is another means of salvation.
To him that worketh not, but believeth on him that justifies the ungodly.
It's another way of salvation. I mean, anyway, we can argue about that. But the point I want to make, that I think he wants to make is. That the Old Testament doesn't have that even that understanding. Okay. Tomorrow we'll allow. In fact, I'll try to not say anything and just let you bring up stuff that you've read in this, and then we'll discuss it and move from there. Okay.